The average person's heart beats 100,000 times every day. That adds up to 2.5 billion beats in the average lifetime. Today on Please Explain, we'll ask how our hearts do all that work, why they sometimes fail, and what we can do to make sure that they stay healthy. My guest is Dr. Peter Libby, Chief of Cardiovascular Medicine at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. He's a professor at Harvard Medical School and the chief medical advisor for the PBS series, The Mysterious Human Heart. Welcome to Please Explain.
It's great to be with you.
What does the heart look like, and how big is the average heart?
Well, I would say that the average human heart is a bit bigger than a fist, and our popular conception is something like a Valentine's heart, and it's not quite that stereotyped. It really does look sort of like a fist, but a little bit bigger.
When we say someone has a big heart, we mean it as a compliment. But if we really do have a big heart, is that a bad thing?
Well, in some kinds of heart disease where the heart muscle weakens, it swells up because it has trouble pumping the blood out of it, and the blood backs up, and so it will become baggy and swollen. And indeed, an enlarged heart like that can be a sign of disease. Some people will have enlargement of the heart because they're very athletic, and that can be a normal response to exercise. So it depends on the way in which the heart enlarges. It can happen in various ways. The wall of the heart can get thicker, or the chambers that are filled with blood can get wider.
But would someone who's 5 feet tall have relatively same size heart as somebody who's 6'8"?
No, not at all. As a matter of fact, the heart generally varies in proportion to the body size, and that's a real consideration that surgeons have to take into account when they are trying to match a heart donor with a heart recipient in transplantation.
And the heart is a pump, so that's why we have the heartbeat. But when a doctor listens for a patient's heartbeat, what does she want to hear?
Well, first of all, you hear sounds that are corresponding to the valves of the heart. The heart has four valves, and when they snap shut, there's a sound. And so we'll listen first for the normal heart sounds and try to assure ourselves that there aren't any extra sounds. And one of the most common things that we listen for with a stethoscope in the heart is an extra sound called a heart murmur. And that can be due either to a valve which is too narrowed or a valve which is leaky.
So you'd hear like thump, thump, thump for the good ones, and then something different for the murmur, for
right.
the bad one?
Right. The murmurs come usually in between the heart sounds, which are due to the valve slamming shut. And we hear them as sort of whooshes or sounds that might be similar to water rushing out of a pipe.
What's the normal range for a healthy pulse?
Between 60 and 100. Is what we usually consider normal. But I'll tell you that some people who are trained athletes may have heartbeats that are quite a bit lower than that, and that's perfectly healthy. It's because they are athletically trained and will have a low heartbeat.
Well, some people just have them because they were born that way. I am not an athlete, and I have a 55. And people always ask me if I'm a runner, and I say, look at me. Do you think I'm a runner?
Well, you know, it's never too late to make physical activity part of your daily life.
But I guess there are other factors that will lead to things like pulse rate and blood pressure and the like.
Right, including medications. Obviously, when we exercise or when we get excited, it's normal for the heartbeat to rev up.
So does the pulse rate decrease when we're asleep?
It certainly does.
What about blood pressure? What's the difference between pulse rate and blood pressure? Aren't they all part of the same thing, the blood being pushed through the body?
They are, but the pulse rate is the frequency at which the heart contracts, and the blood pressure reflects the actual pulse of the blood as it comes out of the heart, and it is determined by the stiffness of the blood vessels or the elasticity of the blood vessels, and the force with which the heart contracts.
If I'm told that my pressure is 120 over 80, what do those two different numbers mean?
Well, the top number, which doctors call the systolic pressure, is the peak pressure. And the bottom number is the minimum that the pulse will have. And we measure it in millimeters of mercury, which is a bit archaic since we actually don't use mercury anymore because it's not environmentally sound. But that is the standard at which we calibrated the blood pressure. So when we say that the top blood pressure is 120 millimeters of mercury, that means that it would support a column of water that's approximately equal to 120 centimeters.
What causes a person to have high or low blood pressure?
Well, high blood pressure is incredibly and concerningly common in our society, particularly in Black Americans who have more of a tendency to develop blood pressure. As a matter of fact, as our population ages, we're facing an epidemic of high blood pressure, particularly of the top number, the systolic blood pressure. And we often have what we call isolated systolic hypertension of the elderly. And the as the boomers gray, there's going to be more and more of us with this condition. And that actually is quite serious because it predisposes us to having strokes and also heart failure. So it's very important for people to know their blood pressure numbers and to try and get them within the ranges that are mandated by our national organizations. And of course, a healthy lifestyle is the most important thing that we can do in terms of controlling our blood pressure. But fortunately, we do have today medicines which are quite well tolerated and which have been proven to reduce the complications of high blood pressure. And there are always a second step after lifestyle. That means a healthy diet and physical activity. But we know that we can make very important inroads against the complications that are due to blood pressure. Now, one of the problems is that you can have high blood pressure but feel perfectly well, so you don't have any symptoms at all. Someone can walk around feeling just fit as a fiddle, but still be in line for having a complication such as a stroke or weakening of the heart muscle, heart failure.
Now, you mentioned, going back to pulse rate, you mentioned that athletes have lower ones. Is that because their hearts are more efficient?
Their hearts are more efficient, but the actual reason that the heart rate slows down has to do more with the nervous control of the heart. Now, the heart is connected to the nervous system, but it's not the part of the nervous system that we actually will, like we can lift our arms or get out of a chair by willing our voluntary muscles to contract in a coordinated way. There's another part of the nervous system that is more autonomous. As a matter of fact, we call it the autonomic nervous system. And it controls the heart rate either by sending signals that are chemical signals to speed up the heartbeat or to slow it down. And what the trained athlete has is a situation where the limb of the nervous system that we can't will actually sends chemical messengers to slow down the heart's own pacemaker.
My guest is Dr. Peter Libby. He's chief of cardiovascular medicine at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston and a professor at Harvard Medical School. We're talking about the heart on today's Please Explain. And much of what I know about the heart is from songs, My Heart Beat Like a Hammer, My Heart Skipped a Beat. Can hearts really skip a beat?
Oh, sure they do. As a matter of fact, we are talking today about a television series which will be airing on PBS. Actually, the premiere was last Monday on the 15th, but if you haven't missed it, it's going to be re-airing, and the third part of this three-part series is going to air on the 22nd. And one of those segments, which aired last week, was called The Spark of Life, and it talks all about, for 50 minutes, about the problems you can get in with a heartbeat being abnormal. And sometimes those can be very innocent. Very commonly, people will have a skipped heartbeat, and it can be, particularly in those with an otherwise normal heart, can be perfectly innocent. But there are problems with the heart rhythm which can be life-threatening. And the PBS series, which was made by filmmaker David Gruben, called The Mysterious Human Heart, has a whole 50-minute segment on that. So I think that listeners who are interested should access that on the web. Or
yeah, the series can be viewed in its entirety online. And if listeners want to visit our show page at wnyc.org, they'll find a link. So we're talking about irregular heartbeat. What about heart palpitations?
Well, palpitations mean different things to patients. When a patient complains of palpitations, what I ask them is, does that mean that your heart is beating forcefully in the chest? You perceive a forceful heartbeat, or is it beating rapidly? And then the next thing I want to know, if they say it's beating rapidly, is it regular or irregular? Because that takes me down different paths in my thinking about what the underlying heart rhythm would be.
Mm-hmm. And what would fast and what would slow mean?
Well, there's a very common condition that causes an irregular heartbeat. As a matter of fact, one that we call irregularly irregular. And that is due to a condition where the upper chambers of the heart, the heart has two upper chambers that we call the atria and two bottom chambers that we call the ventricles. So there are four chambers. The upper chambers are sometimes beat rapidly or ineffectively, and that causes an irregular heartbeat. And this is a condition which is particularly associated with aging. And as the population ages, we're going to be facing an epidemic of this arrhythmia with an irregularly irregular heartbeat called atrial fibrillation. And it's quite a vexing challenge for us to manage that in many people. However, there are low-tech and high-tech kind of management strategies that we employ in order to keep people out of trouble.
Some people will tell you that caffeine will cause heart palpitations.
Oh, no question. Caffeine is one of many precipitants of a rapid heartbeat or irregular heartbeat.
Is heartache only in our minds, or can we really feel emotions in our hearts?
Well, there is a very tight link between emotions in the heart. Clearly, that autonomous limb of our nervous system controls our heartbeat. When we get excited or frightened, the heartbeat will speed up. And it's a clear reflection of our emotions. And in the segment that's going to air on Monday called The Silent Killer, there's a very dramatic story of a patient who actually has a syndrome that we call colloquially the broken heart syndrome, when it can actually mimic a heart attack and in many ways resemble a heart attack to the extent that it can actually fool doctors into thinking that it is an acute heart attack and can be precipitated by an emotional shock. It's more common in women, and we'll be telling the story on Monday night in the episode called The Silent Killer of a woman who has this broken heart syndrome that we call in cardiology the Takotsubo syndrome. And if you want the explanation of that, you'll have to tune in on Monday night.
Well, I do want an explanation for heart attack in general, the regular kind of heart attack.
Right.
What happens? Well, first of all, what causes a heart attack?
Well, the heart is a muscle, but it's a very hungry muscle. You, in your introduction, alluded to how many millions and even billions of times the heart will beat during life, and each of those heartbeats comes at a cost of energy. And to supply energy to the heart, there's a very rich circulation. The heart itself has arteries, and indeed there are three major arteries that supply the blood to the heart. And when those arteries become blocked, either because of narrowings or a blood clot, it can lead to a limitation of the blood flow, which delivers oxygen and nutrients to the heart. And when one of those arteries blocks off for a sustained period, it can cause a death of the heart muscle, and that can weaken the heart muscle. And that's what a heart attack actually is when there's a lack of blood flow that starves that part of the heart muscle, and it will eventually die, and a scar will form.
Sometimes people think they're having a heart attack when they're actually having some other kind of a thing, a digestive tract problem.
That's right. There are many masquerades that can mimic a heart attack, but the symptoms which you read about and hear about in the media of a pressing chest pressure beneath the breastbone or in front of the heart, one that can travel down the arms, particularly the left arm, can be felt as a heaviness or numbness. Those are symptoms which are more characteristic of heart kind of discomfort than other kinds of discomfort. And if people have that, particularly if it's accompanied with a feeling of malaise or sweating or shortness of breath, there's one thing to do, and that is to activate the emergency medical system, just dial 911, because time is muscle. And again, we'll talk about that in the show on Monday night. And all kinds of mischief can happen. And we have many wonderful ways in which we can alleviate that or reduce the risk of having a complication of a heart attack, including death. So rather than sit around and hope that it'll go away, I would really urge listeners who have those kinds of symptoms to activate the emergency medical system. Now, that said, we're increasingly concerned about an epidemic of heart risk and heart disease in women, and often women don't quite fit the textbook mold.
Dr. Libby, we have to take a little break. I want to come back to that,
the
heart attacks for men and women, and we'll be taking listener calls in the second part of this. So stay with us, okay? I'm talking with Dr. Peter Libby, who is the chief medical advisor for the PBS series, The Mysterious Human Heart, and he's chief of cardiovascular medicine at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston and a professor at Harvard Medical School. We'll be back right after this with more Please Explain.
What is beating, beating, beating here?
What is throbbing, throbbing in my ear?
What is beating, throbbing, throbbing, throbbing in my ear?
It must be my own heart, my loving and long heart.
We're back with Dr. Peter Libby, chief of cardiovascular medicine at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. He's a professor at Harvard Medical School and the chief medical advisor for the PBS series, The Mysterious Human Heart, which is still running on PBS. In fact, the next installment will be on Monday, October 22nd at 9 p.m. You can also view the series in its entirety online. Visit our show page at wnyc.org for a link. And we just heard a little bit from Così fan tutti. Mozart was already writing songs about the heart?
That's right. The particular aria that you just played is one that we actually feature in the soundtrack for the episode that's going to air on Monday night, The Silent Killer. And it's one of the best depictions that I know of the heartbeat in the Western canon of music.
But I would assume that more songs have been written about the heart than any other part of the body.
I think that in poetry and in our common parlance and in music, the heart is a very common theme. I was working with David Gruben, the filmmaker, on this series, and he was quite enchanted by the link between the heart and emotions and the heart in literature. And when I listened to Bach's St. Matthew Passion around Easter time, I was struck with the very consistent imagery with the heart in that very religious piece.
Our number here is 212-433-9692 if you would like to talk with Dr. Peter Libby about the heart. A couple of more things before we get to the calls. You've mentioned exercise as a good way to keep your heart healthy. Exercise, I'm assuming, lifestyle in general, diet. What about genetics? How important a role do they play in healthy hearts?
Well, genetics is extremely important in cardiovascular risk. But the problem is there's nothing you can do about it. You can't choose your parents. So if you do have a history in your family of close relatives who've had heart trouble at a young age, we consider that less than 55 for men or less than 65 for women, then that means that you have to be particularly punctilious, pay a great deal of attention to the lifestyle measures, which include a healthy diet. And now you use the word exercise, and actually with many of my patients, I avoid the word exercise because that conjures up an idea of someone wearing Lycra spandex and sweatbands and working out in a gym. And that's not what it takes to derive a cardiovascular benefit from physical activity. And what I encouraged you to do earlier was to make physical activity part of your daily life. And
well, I walk a lot.
Yeah. Well, that's exactly.
And I live in a walk-up. I wish I had an elevator, but I live in a walk-up, and I think that it's probably the best thing I could do.
Absolutely. There's abundant evidence that rather small but achievable for real people increases in physical activity can really translate into reduced risk for having heart trouble. So I think that you're an excellent example for the listeners. If you have a choice of waiting for the elevator or walking up a flight or two, take the choice, the healthy choice, of walking up the steps. You know, in our daily lives, we are faced by choices many, many times a day where we can make the healthy choice or we can make the less healthy choice.
Before we get to the calls, I just want to backtrack to where we were before we took that break, and you were talking about men and women and heart attacks. Are heart attacks different for men and women?
The symptoms that are in the textbooks, which were generally written by men, and at a time when heart disease, heart attack in particular, struck men much more than women, those rules don't really apply to women. And unfortunately, women are becoming an increasing target of heart disease as the population ages, and also as the spectrum of risk factors for heart trouble that we have in our community changes. So women have to be really vigilant that they mind their cardiovascular risk factors to reduce their risk, because they're not at all protected. As a matter of fact, a woman is probably about five times more likely to die of heart trouble than breast cancer. Now, that's not to trivialize the importance of breast cancer, but merely to heighten the importance of heart trouble in women. And women may not have those textbook symptoms of the elephant standing on their chest. They may feel much more subtle kinds of malaise, shortness of breath, and the discomfort that women feel when they're having a heart attack may not fit the rule book from men. So I think that they have to have a very high index of suspicion.
Well, you are the chief of cardiovascular medicine at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. We are taking listener calls at 212-433-9692, and you'll be talking to Dr. Peter Libby. Right now, we put Josh from Manhattan on the air.
Hi.
Go ahead, Josh.
I'll try to do this as quickly as possible. When I was a young kid, age 10, age 12, I had two or three episodes of what I thought, or what I guess was called tachycardia, where I had a very fast heartbeat. And then they did some EKGs at the time. And my doctor, my more recent doctor, who's also a cardiologist, looked at one of those older EKGs that my parents had kept. And he says that I may have an extra electrical pathway in my heart. So I guess you're supposed to have one, and I may have two. And it's not something I'm necessarily should be concerned about now at the age of 33, but something that could be a problem later on.
Right. Well, is that true?
Yes, you described it very, very well. Some people who have rapid heart action will have an extra pathway in the wiring system that connects the upper chambers to the lower chambers of the heart. And the good news is that we have a lot of ways in which we can take care of that with medications. And now we have some pretty slick ways that we can actually, we call it ablate the arrhythmia by going in and taking a little radio frequency and just hitting the place where that extra pathway is, which we can map out in the we call it the electrophysiology laboratory. And in fact, in the episode called The Spark of Life, which you can see through the link which we've heard about on the web, you can find more about this kind of therapy. But not everyone needs that kind of invasive treatment, and the good thing is it sounds like this was a problem which you had when you were 10 or 12, but has not been a problem in your life, has not been recurrent, and hasn't interfered with your function. And so we'll just cross our fingers that that will continue. But if you ever were to have recurrent symptoms and those that couldn't be controlled with simpler measures, there's some very reliable, definitive therapies which can almost always solve that problem.
Thank you so much for calling us. Bill from Long Island, you're on the air.
Gentlemen, good afternoon. Dr. Libby, I have a question. If you suspect that you're having symptoms from a heart attack, is there anything you can take? I've heard that you could take aspirin or something like that that could possibly help the situation.
Well, the first thing that you do is call 911, but certainly if you aren't taking aspirin, to chew a non-coated aspirin is probably a prudent thing to do.
Non-coated because it gets into your system quicker?
That's right.
Okay, and that's because it thins the blood.
Well, yes. What aspirin does is it blocks one of the little elements in the blood that we call a platelet that is implicated very strongly in the kinds of blood clots that can cause heart attacks because they block the flow through one of those arteries that supply blood to the heart.
Thank you so much for calling us, Bill. We go now to Christy from Maplewood, New Jersey. Hi, you're on. Please explain.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. Dr. Libby, I have mitral valve prolapse, and I just had a question. There seems to be a change in the recommendation for pre-medication for dental visits, and I actually have an appointment coming up on Tuesday, so I wanted to know if you could help clarify that for me. We used to have to take antibiotics in the past, and now I'm told that that's not necessary anymore.
Right. We used to take people who had mitral valve prolapse. So the mitral valve is the valve that separates the upper chamber and the lower chamber on the left side of the heart. That's the main pumping chamber of the heart. And mitral valve prolapse is when that valve has a generous leaflet and it tends to pop backwards and allow some blood to leak. If there was evidence on our exam, listening with a stethoscope or doing an echocardiogram of a leak in that valve, very often we would recommend before a dental procedure or other kinds of interventions that you take antibiotics. And you're quite right that there has been a relaxation in the rules because taking antibiotics is not without some kind of a price. And I'm not talking just about the economic price, but we have to be concerned about antibiotic resistance in the community. We need to be concerned also about the allergies which can happen or interactions with other drugs. So it's not something which we undertake lightly. And what I'd encourage you to do is go to the website of the American Heart Association and take a look at the latest guidelines and see in conjunction with your doctor whether or not you're the kind of person who would need to have the antibiotics before procedure. But you're quite right is that for many people with mitral valve prolapse or other kinds of valvular heart disease, we no longer recommend routine antibiotics before a dental procedure.
My guest is Dr. Peter Libby, Chief of Cardiovascular Medicine at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. And Sarah from Manhattan, you're on. Please explain.
Hi, Dr. Libby. Thanks for taking my call. I was diagnosed a few years ago with an arrhythmia that does not seem to affect my daily life. I don't usually feel it, but I'm sort of running on 3-4 time, as it were, like regularly the third or fourth heartbeat is irregular. And from what I understand from the cardiologist, the treatment for this is really so much worse than the syndrome. So I'm not on any medication, but during my discussion with the cardiologist and after the workup, he said, well, your heart is working at 75% efficiency, and that's good. Of course, being a New Yorker, you always want to be in the top 3% of anything. So as a middle-aged woman who doesn't exercise, what does 75% efficiency mean, and how does one kind of regard one's heart's efficiency rate?
Right. I suspect that what your doctor was referring to is something we call the ejection fraction, which is a measure of how much blood the heart squeezes out with every beat. And I would guess that your heart is squeezing out 75% of its filling with every beat. And that's actually, you want to be in the top 3%, I would say you're there, because the normal range of that number is between 55 and 77, approximately. So if you're at 75, you're right up there, and that's a good squeeze. But the important thing about your arrhythmia is that it sounds like it's asymptomatic. It's not something which has caused any problem. You haven't lost consciousness. It's not interfering with your life. There are different kinds of skipped beats. They can come from the upper chamber or the lower chamber. And if they're asymptomatic, particularly in someone who has a normal heart, functioning heart, and if your ejection fraction is 75, if that was the 75 number is, you're just fine, then I agree with the management of watchful waiting. And once again, there are approaches that we can take to more definitive resolution of arrhythmias, but someone who is asymptomatic, we certainly wouldn't engage in any invasive treatment for that. There are things that can make arrhythmias worse, like drinking coffee. We talked about that earlier. So if you began to have symptoms, there's some simple lifestyle measures that you could undertake in order to try and manage it.
Thank you so much for your call. A listener has emailed us asking why we don't see cancers or tumors of the heart more often.
Well, we do. We do have cancers. There are two kinds of cancers which can affect the heart. There are secondary cancers that will come from other organs, for example, the lung, and will spread to the heart, and they can cause some mischief there, and that's a pretty serious situation. Also, we can get accumulations of fluid around the heart when there are other tumors that take up residence in the lining of the heart, and that can be a serious problem challenge for us with patients with malignancies. But there are also some primary tumors of the heart, but they're pretty rare. And on the big picture of the kinds of heart disease that preoccupy us in our practices, primary malignancies of the heart are a tiny, tiny fraction.
We go now to April from Astoria. Hi, you're on.
Hi.
Please Explain.
Hi, good afternoon. I'd like to ask Dr. Olivia a question. I'm 52 years old. I'm like 5'4" and 98 pounds, so I'm skinny. I don't get a lot of sleep. Maybe on average 5 hours. When I wake up, I am tired. Now, first question I want to ask is, how does lack of sleep affect the heart? And number two is, once I was getting pains in my left arm and was running from the shoulder down to the hand, and I was sort of like shaking my wrist to try and see if the pain would go away. And I went to the hospital, and they put the EKG or whatever test they were. But sometimes by the time you get to the hospital, the pain is gone. I'm wondering, does the test pick up what was happening a half an hour ago, or the pain has to be there when you're in the emergency room? That's what I wanted to know about the sleep and when they take the test when you're in the hospital.
Well, there's a lot there. I would say that I'd be more concerned about your general health and function with the sleep and would try to ferret out what kind of issues are causing that lack of sleep, and that's something you could discuss with your primary care doctor. In terms of direct links with the heart, the kind of sleeplessness that concerns us most is what's called obstructive sleep apnea, which can be associated with problems of the heartbeat, the rhythm as well. And that usually happens in people who are quite a bit overweight or obese, and that doesn't sound like it's the problem with you, and also those people will generally snore. So it doesn't sound like that's the part that is bothering you. And with respect to your question about the arm discomfort, if you've had damage to your heart muscle, there are blood tests that will reveal that for many, many days afterwards. And routinely in someone who we suspect clinically had some injury to their heart, we would measure those blood tests. The electrocardiogram often will have a sustained abnormality if someone has had heart injury. But not all episodes of lack of blood flow are permanent. We can have episodes that are temporary, and we call those angina. And the best way to scope that out is to get a stress test with your doctor, and some of the stress tests are monitored with radioisotopes. Some are monitored just through electrocardiogram, and that's the kind of conversation you should engage with a cardiologist. But if you have, particularly if it's related to effort, a left arm discomfort, it would be a good thing to get a consultation and consider whether you're a candidate for a stress test.
Now, we spoke recently to the winner of the Lasker Award about pig valve transplants, but aren't heart transplants usually human hearts? Can have animal heart transplants been successful?
Only for very limited amounts of time. This is not a routine clinical practice because we face tremendous barriers, immunologic barriers, to accepting hearts from other species, what we call xenotransplantation. And the approach to heart transplantation today is to use the human hearts. We're increasingly learning how to use mechanical devices, But, you know, I'm ultimately, although I have an intense research interest in heart transplantation and the immunology of rejection of hearts and the blood vessel problems that are part of heart transplantation, as a preventive cardiologist, I view the need for a heart transplant as really a failure of prevention in most cases. And so what I think we need to do as a society is to try to nip the problem of heart trouble in the bud well before we get to the stage of needing a heart transplant.
What about stem cell research? Does it offer any promise for being able to make new heart muscle tissue?
Well, it's a very, very promising, exciting prospect, but it's nowhere ready for regular clinical use today. It's an exciting subject of research and investigation throughout the world. Unfortunately, the United States is a bit at a disadvantage to some other countries because of restrictions that have been placed on embryonic stem cell research in our country. So we do have some jeopardy in our competitiveness because of these restrictions in our research. But time will tell whether or not we're able to harness this very exciting technology in a way which will improve patients' outcomes.
My great thanks to Dr. Peter Libby, Chief of Cardiovascular Medicine at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. He's a professor at Harvard Medical School and the chief medical advisor to the PBS series, The Mysterious Human Heart, which is airing on PBS on Mondays. And the next segment will be on the 22nd at 9 p.m. And the whole series can be viewed online. A visit to our show page at WNYC.org will lead you to a link. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be with you. Thank you very much.